four-legged friends in the audience. So for anyone who would like to watch the hearing but maybe don't want to spend the whole time in this room, we have an overflow area outside the Senate chambers where you can watch on TV if that's your preference. Let's see. Do we have bills here?
I have one LC draft in front of me.
2932, yes. We will quickly open up a work session for purposes of measure introduction. Senator Beyer.
Madam Chair, I move LC 2932 be introduced as a committee bill.
Senator Beyer has moved LC 2932 as a committee bill. Is there any discussion? Any objections? So ordered. Thank you. Okay, we're going to go out of order on the agenda here, and we're going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 438. Council.
Thank you, Chair Bardick and members of the committee. Senate Bill 438 modifies current law. Under current ORS 167.352, it's a Class A misdemeanor to intentionally or knowingly interfere with, injure, or attempt to injure an assistance animal, a search and rescue animal, or a therapy animal. What Senate Bill 438 does is it removes assistance animals from ORS 167.352, and it creates a special statute dealing specifically with the new crimes of first and second degree hindering an assistance animal. Second-degree hindering, a Class A misdemeanor, provides two primary changes. First, it lowers the mental requirement from intentional or knowing under present law to reach persons that act with criminal negligence. The second substantive change that Senate Bill 438 does is it allows for the prosecution of dog keepers when the person's dog injures or interferes with an assistance animal. In addition, Senate Bill 438 expands first-degree animal abuse to include a provision relating to the death of an assistance animal, and it modifies provisions relating to civil actions arising from injuries to assistance animals. Finally, it expands the definition of public nuisance dogs.
Okay. We'll start out with Marshall Koba, Kay Madera, and Patricia Kepler. And invite you all up, and if you would need any assistance, just let us know. And your dogs. Welcome to the committee, and welcome to your dogs, too.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Chair Koba.
And members of the committee, good afternoon. I'm Marshall Koba here this afternoon, and it's an honor for me to represent the Guide Dog Uses of Oregon in support of Senate Bill 438. First, I'd like to thank the committee for this hearing, and I'd also like to thank Senator Bruce Starr for his assistance in getting the bill drafted. Senate Bill 438 expands and strengthens the policy that guide dogs and all assistant animals are a valuable and important partner to the independence of many Oregonians. This bill further acknowledges and protects this relationship and adds penalties to those who may violate it. I remind the Committee of Oregon's strong commitment to independent living. Our Project Independence is acknowledged as a national leader. Senate Bill 438, I believe, adds to independence by protecting the valuable relationships between the handler and the assistance animal. If I may also add here, Madam Chair, that one of my other clients is AARP Oregon. I'd like to add to the record that AARP Oregon is in support of this legislation as well. I'd also like to point out that once the bill was scheduled, there was some concern expressed by a couple different organizations about the language on page 6, lines 44 and 45, which added non-economic damages. One of those being the Oregon Veterinary Medical Association. We've talked with those folks and others and are agreeable to removing the language on page 6, lines 44 and 45 relating to non-economic damages. I'd like to turn it over now to Kay Madera and her testimony. Thank you.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. I'm not sure where it's here. Okay. My name is Kay Madera, and Senator Burdick and members of the committee, thank you for allowing us to be here today with our dogs to come and visit you and to share with you why Senate Bill 438 is so important to us. I'm not here only representing the American Council of the Blind of Oregon and Guide Dog Users of Oregon, but I'm also a dog guide handler of some 30 years. And it's been my joy to see that Oregon has always been in the forefront of promoting legislation for disability groups and legislation for blind Oregonians. An organization that I work fondly with, Independent Living Resources in Portland, also we like to teach our folks how to advocate, and this is a wonderful opportunity to be here and share with you our concerns about what needs to happen to improve the lives of guide dogs and other service animals who work in the field of to assist disabled Oregonians. Oregon has always been in the forefront promoting rights of the disabled, and it is my belief that this bill can continue in this wonderful tradition of doing so. We are not here merely to dazzle you with stories of emotion and heartbreak, but we're here to talk with you about a real problem that we face. There are over 300 guide dog users in the state of Oregon alone. Now, that may not seem like a lot, but when you consider that in Oregon there are about 7,000 or so blind citizens, 300 of those citizens or less or more use guide dogs. And 100 of those individuals are graduates of Guide Dogs for the Blind. In a recent survey conducted by this school, 50% of the graduates in Oregon stated that they had had unpleasant animal or dog encounters in Oregon alone. Nationally, we found this to be true as well. Other states, Oregon, Washington, California, Colorado, New York, to name a few, have strengthened their laws to protect their service dogs, assistance animals, from being attacked by loose dogs. There are 12 other guide dog schools in the country, and along with Guide Dogs for the Blind, other people who come from these schools also report in Oregon that their dogs have been attacked, or we don't like that word attacked, but assaulted, or you know, bothered, or had unpleasant animal experiences. And because of this, they're often afraid to walk in their neighborhoods. The freedom and independence that we experience with our dogs is such that we like to be able to go about in our communities. But when we are confronted by dogs that are out of control, dogs that are loose and unable to be contained, and our dogs are attacked, we are left in a really vulnerable position. And that's one reason that this bill was put together in the first place, because we're finding that many dogs have to be retired after experiencing something like this. The dogs that you see today in this room are Labrador Retrievers, Golden Retrievers, German Shepherds, Poodles, and these dogs have been trained for the most part to be, well, they don't like to fight. They're lovers rather than fighters, most of them, and they are taught not to be aggressive. And so we, knowing this, these dogs do not respond aggressively to other animals usually. So when they are confronted with an aggressive dog, it's their nature to turn and run. And what happens when this occurs is that oftentimes dogs get seriously injured and can be retired from work. You'll hear such a story today from one of my colleagues. These dogs, the training of these dogs, are approximately $50,000 or more. It provides training for one dog. One guide dog is worth more than $50,000 in training. So when you think about that and you think that a dog has been assaulted and attacked in this way, we're talking about money that's being, wasted. And when a dog has to be retired and can no longer serve as an important member of the team, then the guide dog handler has to go back for retraining. This means that he has to be taken away from work. He has to be taken away from, he has to go away from his family for 3 weeks of training. And he has to get used to a whole new dog all over again. So these are why we're here today to talk to you about this bill. And we want you to understand that we're not just here to criticize pet owners, but we want to underscore the important need of responsibility. And that's why this bill was drafted, is to talk about the responsibility that all of us need to take for keeping our dogs under control. If I go into a restaurant and you're in that restaurant with me, you expect me to behave myself. And if you see my guide dog, actually, you expect him to be good, too. You expect him not to come and take your steak or your hamburger sandwich. And if he did, I'd have to owe you one, wouldn't I? I'd have to buy you another steak. So what I want to say is that what we really feel is important is not that we're trying to criticize individuals for having the freedom of having their own dogs, but to ask people to be responsible. And when attacks do occur, there needs to be some understanding and some remedy for the tremendous damage that can be caused. And that's why I'm here as a guide dog user. I've had 6 dogs in 30 years. Bailey, my black lab at my feet, has recently experienced a little unpleasant encounter in an elevator in the doctor's office when a dog decided to break away from his master and jump on top of him to play. Well, Bailey was in his harness trying to do his job, and this dog jumped on top of him, and he didn't mean anything by it. And I think most owners' dogs don't mean anything by it, and most owners don't. But I had to grab this little fellow by the scruff of the neck and return him to his master. Say, here you go, here's your dog. And throughout that whole rest of the visit to the doctor's office, my dog was nervous. Now, he didn't experience any injury. Just think what would happen if he had. And that's why I'm here today, and I thank you for the opportunity of sharing. And if you have any questions, I'd be glad to answer them. And I thank you for listening to my testimony and allowing me to share with you this afternoon. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you. We will hold questions till the panel is done. Our next witness is Patricia Kepler. And Patricia, we have your testimony in front of us, so don't feel that you have to read the
testimony. I wasn't going to say the whole thing. I just had a couple things I wanted to say.
Could you identify yourself for the record?
Oh, I'm sorry.
Thank you.
Yeah, I'm Patricia Kepler from Aloha, Oregon. I'm here as personal citizen, as well as representative Guide Dog Users of Oregon and Independent Living Resources in Portland, Oregon. As you already stated, you have my written testimony, which describes both guide dog attacks that I've had to deal with, one dog being rehabilitated and the other one having to retire after the trauma because of how it affected him. And interesting enough, as Kay kind of stated, my first dog was physically injured. My second one was not physically harmed. He was fine, but the incident was so traumatic, it left him fearful of wearing his harness and fearful of getting too close to other dogs when in harness. On a leash, walking as a pet, he's perfectly fine around other dogs. But when in his harness, he thinks he's trapped, and he cannot guide. So he had to be retired at the age of 5. There's so much that these dogs do, which is why this bill is so important. You know, there's a room full of guide dog handlers here today, and they came from all over the state. They came today to share the support for this bill to let you know how important it was. Getting here without any orientation to this building, you know, telling these dogs, find the elevator, find the door, find the chair, and when we leave, they'll be telling them that again, and getting out of here as independent, respectable adults, which is what these dogs bring us. They bring us our respectability. And that's taken away very quickly by somebody who lets their dog run loose, as happened in my case. As in my statement, I no longer walk around my neighborhood as I should be able to, because I can't afford to have this dog attack too. If I were to have another dog retired due to the same incident from my neighbor who doesn't seem to think his dog needs to be in his yard, no school in their right mind would trust another dog to me. I would have to give up the choice of using a guide dog if I was to put my dog in danger. So instead, I use paratransit, which is very expensive. They say door-to-door service costs $35 each way on their transit budget. So to and from work each day, I'm doing that rather than fixed route buses because it's not safe for me to walk in my own neighborhood. There are puppy raisers here. There's a guide dog trainer here who I'd like to speak. She represents Guide Dogs for the Blind and has some very interesting statistics. If she has time, I would like her to speak as well. But, you know, they're all here to share their same story, that they put all their hearts and hard work into making these animals so that we can live our lives just as you live yours. And we really need the protection of this law. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Are there questions from the panel? Okay, thank you very much. I'm going to call our next panel. I want to give priority to the people who actually have dogs with them. So if I read your name and you don't have a dog, if you just pass and we'll take you after we take the people with dogs. Candace Twomakoski. Ah, so you got dog in tow here. Nicole Palmatier. Now, I thought about having you up together. If you're worried about your dogs getting along, I could take you separately. Okay, Nicole will wait. Barbara Suber.
Thanks.
And Joseph Brinkman is the last one I have here. And again, if you want to wait, do you want to wait and come up separately? Okay. Okay, welcome to the committee. You can go in whatever order you choose here. I think Candace was signed up first.
All right. Excuse me, I'm getting over a cold. My name is Candace Twomakoski. I'm an instructor with Guide Dogs for the Blind. I've been with the organization about 10 years, and in that time I've heard of very, very many attacks, a lot of sad stories. I know I don't have a lot of time, so I wanted to share some statistics with you. Since January of 2004, we've received 260 calls from our graduates. That's out of about 2,000 graduates. We're getting that many calls. 144 of those dogs had to go seek vet assistance, and some of those dogs were retired. When I refer to being retired, that means they can no longer do the job. So you may have a dog that's only been out for about a year that can no longer do the job just because somebody has not stopped their dog from attacking it. A 10-year study was done by the Dog Bite Law website. Excuse me. In that time, the pet dog society has grown about 2%. Unfortunately, dog bites have grown 33%. Very, very large growing problem. In 2003, a survey was done by Guide Dog Users Incorporated. 42% of the guide dog handlers had been attacked in that survey. And of that, 85% were on a public right-of-way. So they were just like everybody else was talking about, walking down the street when this attack occurred. A lot of the problems are handling with the dogs that are repeat offenders, dogs that have been out, they've attacked before, there's been no response to it, so the owners aren't doing anything, so the dogs are attacking again. As our organization sees it, we need to work in three areas. Law enforcement, legislation, as well as responsibility of the pet owner. If we can put some teeth into the law, then we can give the law enforcement something that they can do to help the population. Thank you very much for giving me the time.
Thank you.
My name is Barbara Server, and I'm a Guide Dogs for the Blind puppy volunteer raiser and leader in Beaverton, Oregon. I'm also a pet owner of three pets. I'm here today because I just, I want to let people know this is a volunteer job I've done for 15 years. I get these puppies at 8 weeks old. I raise them to approximately 14 to 18 months old. I put my heart and soul in raising a dog that's going to guide a blind person. And it's heartbreaking when I see these dogs have to be retired. I personally know people whose dogs have had to be retired due to the dog attacks. In my own neighborhood with my own pet dogs, I recently cannot walk in my neighborhood because of dogs that are attacking. I'm unable to take my guide dog puppy in my neighborhood. I have to get in the car and drive to another neighborhood or to an enclosed mall. I have several puppy raisers in the past year who have had dog attacks on Guide Dogs for the Blind. As they say, these dogs, upon completion and graduation, are worth $50,000 plus. So something definitely has to be done about making responsible pet ownership. Part of my job is going and speaking at schools, and I try to educate even young children to be responsible pet owners. Every group that I go to, every Rotary Club, it's not just about Guide Dogs for the Blind. It's also about responsible pet ownership. If we were able to actually quote a law that is now in effect that lets people know that there will be consequences if you aren't responsible. I feel this would benefit every assistance dog out there. So just from the puppy raiser point of view, it's a lot of work. It's a 24-hour-a-day job. These dogs go to work with us. They go everywhere with us. And we're just trying to make a good dog, and we just don't want to see them be ruined by another dog attacking them. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Thank you for coming, and thank you for doing what you do. It truly is a labor of love. Are there questions from the committee? Okay. Thank you very much. We will, before we call our next witness, I want to let the committee know that we have you have a statement in front of you from Jennifer Moon from Woodburn, who will not be testifying but has submitted testimony for the record, so that will be included in the record. Okay, Joseph Brinkman. The dog was sound asleep a minute ago.
Resting, just getting ready.
Yes.
Good afternoon. My name is Joseph Brinkman. I live in Beaverton, Oregon, and work in Southwest Portland. I use mass transit, including MAX trains, streetcars, and buses. I am also a volunteer for Guide Dogs for the Blind out of San Rafael, California. I raise and train guide dog puppies for the blind. I have had numerous incidents where I've had the need to physically protect my working dog from both people and animals. As for the people issues, it ranges from drunks, dope heads, skateboarders, and operators of motor vehicles. As for the animal issues, it has been anything from neighbor's dogs on my property, pit bulls on street on public sidewalks, and people violating current law by bringing pets on public transportation not in travel crates. I also have had to break up at least one dog fight. I've been training working dogs for nearly 20 years and seeing more and more criminal behavior as time goes by both dogs and the owners. A working dog may have up to 3,000 hours of training before getting to the end user, but can be lost in one unfortunate incident. As current dog control in Washington County now stands, of which I've had to use, if a person reports to the animal control officer that his or her working dog has been attacked, menaced, or otherwise harassed, the complainant must fill out an 8-page incident report by hand and pay a $35 non-refundable investigation fee for the Washington County Animal Control to even act on any animals or animal keepers. Frankly, I don't see a blind person filling out an 8-page report by hand or paying any fee. Some of the community of vision impaired live on food stamps and rent subsidies. This issue still needs to be addressed by law. There are other issues still in need of fixing by law. Secondly, drivers of motor vehicles not remaining stopped until a working dog reaches an opposite curb while crossing a street. The penalty for that should be the suspension of driving privilege for a year. Nearly killing a pedestrian is a very serious crime for running late to an appointment or going shopping. Thirdly, people who do not yield for working dog on public transportation, for example, not giving up the handicapped seats or don't move out of the way for working dog to enter the train, even if this means getting off the train for the person to get on with the dog. Fourth and the final issue I would like to raise is the street people who block city sidewalks or right-of-ways who don't get out of the way of working dogs. Why should a vision impaired person have to go onto the street to get by these people? How are these kind of interference penalized by a monetary fine only if they don't have an income? They need to go to jail or work camps. Thank you for helping out working dogs. Safe, safe.
Thank you. What stage of training is your puppy there?
She's just in a fifth week of training. She's only 4 months old. So she's basically on a COME command, which is very important to recalling the dog on food. So if they ever get away from a person walking their dog off the harness, it'll come immediately back to them and won't get hit by a car or something. So she's just very early in the stage right now.
Okay, she's very cute.
Thank you.
Are there other questions from the committee? Thank you for coming. Okay, now we'll take Glenn Kolb from the Oregon Veterinary Medical Association. Welcome.
Thank you, Chair Burdick, Vice Chair Beyer, and other committee members. My name is Glenn Kolb. I'm Executive Director with the Oregon Veterinary Medical Association. I have submitted written testimony, and our concern really has been addressed by Mr. Kolb's proposed amendment, and with the amendment, we do support the bill.
Okay. Could you please describe your amendment for the committee for the record?
This would be Mr. Kolb's proposed amendment.
Marshall, do you want to come back up and voice it in? Because I have some questions about it. I wanted to get on the record.
Once again, Madam Chair, Marshall Kova, representing the Guide Dog Users of Oregon. I'll try to answer the question. I can tell you what the amendment is. I'm not sure I can answer the questions. But on page 6 of the bill, at line 44 and 45, there is a economic and non-economic damages. I believe the amendment would simply delete and non-economic, so it would read economic damages against the keeper of a dog.
Okay. It's my understanding from talking to our counsel that by removing non-economic damages, you will be removing something that is currently in the statute. Counsel, did you want to elaborate on that?
Sure. My understanding, if you look at existing Oregon law, 346.687, it's entitled Damages Recoverable for Harm or Theft of Assistance Animal. It's probably easiest if I just read. What it says is a physically impaired person who uses an assistance animal or the owner of an assistance animal may bring an action for economic and non-economic damages against any person who steals or, without provocation, attacks the assistance animal. The physically impaired person or owner may also bring an action for such damages against the owner of any animal that, without provocation, attacks an assistance animal. So, Chair Burdick, my read on present law is that non-economic damages are available whether it's a person who attacks or the person's dog who attacks.
Okay. Senator Pozanski.
Yeah, Madam Chair, and Council probably knows this, but I'll just point it out on page 6 where Mr. Kolb talked about that language is still intact and would stay in the bill as it's written on lines 41, where it basically, I don't know if it's the exact statute that Council just read or not. So it seems like you'd be having, you know, somewhat of a cross-purpose of wanting to take something out that's already there.
That was my point, yeah, that it's already in the statute. And I think when I was first approached about this amendment, I was under the impression it was not in the statute and that it was something that was going to be added. So I guess what I'd be interested in finding out is if there have been any issues around non-economic damages that make you want to delete them.
I think our concern, Madam Chair, committee members, I think our concern about non-economic damages is raising and elevating the status of the animals in the sense that in court cases in Oregon, the most recent one being in Clackamas County, the courts have found that they were not going to consider economic or non-economic damages in that case, and concerned with about a broader foothold in the future, which we do think would have implications, unintended perhaps, for not only veterinarians but also kennels, groomers, could be with animal control, and also about humane shelters as well.
I guess what I'm trying to get at is it's been in the law. Have you seen any problems?
I'm unaware of any problems with this restriction. No.
Okay. Do you have anything to add?
I don't believe so. The one substantive change that this appears to make to the non-economic damages provision, Chair Burdick, from my perspective, is that right now, in terms of the phrase is attacks, it's an undefined phrase. So if a person attacks an assistance animal or if a person's dog attacks an assistance animal, then these damages are available. And the bill changes the language of attacks to injures or disables.
Mm-hmm.
And so there perhaps is some definitional change there. But again, the non-economic damages component exists in present law, whether it's the dog or the person.
Well, it would seem to me that if you're specifying it has to be an injury or disabling the assistance animal, then you're actually, for the for these purposes, it's actually narrowing down the use of non-economic, because attack is very vague. Anything could be construed as an attack. But the new language for non-economic damage is specific to injury or disabling the dog.
Chair Burdick, I'd have to go back and look at that. I don't have a copy of that in front of me to talk with Laura Smith about that, but okay. I'm glad that we take a look at that.
Okay. All right. We will consider that. Senator Cruz.
Yeah. Just if you go to Section 1 and read the new definition of disabled and injured, I think it broadens it back out. So that's something we probably ought to have counsel take a look at and see if that indeed broadens it just by the new definitions in Section 1.
Mm-hmm. Okay, that's a good point. And we will get that analyzed. Okay, are there any other questions of these two from the committee? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, now we will go to Mary Botkin and Nicole Palmateer. I think you can come up together.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Great minds think alike. Nicole and I just sort of looked at each other and said, "Sure." For the record, I'm here representing the American Federation of State, County, Municipal Employees. We represent folks who work in animal control in the counties, and we're here in favor.
Your name would be?
I'm sorry, Mary Botkin.
She's new.
It's all right. I do it all the time still.
And we're here in support of this bill. We too have horrific stories. Last session, our animal control officers provided me graphic pictures, which I have chosen not to bring, of two attacks on service dogs by vicious dogs that were running loose, and the horrific tragedy that followed. And I do want to say that service dogs are not just for the blind anymore. We have service dogs that we know of that work within human services and mental health services and any number of programs that require some sort of assistance. Our clients have found that dogs are an incredible resource. And just in closing, I want to say it also provides some rather unique jobs for us. In the prison system, we have inmates who are training service dogs. So it is this is a great program, and we ought to protect these dogs at every level. Thank you.
Thank you for coming. Other questions from the committee? Senator Pazansky.
I have one question. The witness that testified before talked about a fee that has to be paid to, I guess it was Washington County, for investigations of these type of attacks. I wonder if you could just find out, I'm not that it's not true, but why it's in place. I mean, that seems kind of counterproductive for...
I think it's budget issues, but I'm going to find out.
Maybe budget
for
issues,
sure.
But does that mean that we're going to have that for a person that needs to have law enforcement involved, that we're going to now charge them to have an investigation?
I actually have that on my notes. It says $35 for complaints, ? And I don't know if all of our animal control centers use that format or not. It's the first I've heard of it, and so I'm going to find out. And we do not represent Washington County, so I don't know, but I will find out and get back to you.
Okay, please, thank you. Okay, any other questions? All right, Ms. Palmateer.
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Nicole Palmateer, here representing O4AD, the Oregon Association of Area Agencies on Aging and Disabilities. As you're all aware, we represent seniors and people with physical disabilities, and we're pleased to testify today in support of this bill. The people that we represent and advocate on a daily basis use service animals regularly to overcome a lot of things in life that we all take for granted on a day-to-day basis. As Mary referred to, assistance animals do a lot these days for the physically disabled, opening and closing doors, turning light switches on and off. Most importantly, providing mobility and independence to a person to allow them to be able to live their life with the respect and the dignity that Oregon is very committed to providing for. They provide that flexibility and choice in every single day, and we support this bill providing additional protections for those people with disabilities and their service animals. And I can say that we do represent Washington County's Area Agency on Aging, and I can help Mary in finding out that answer. I have also wrote it down here to go run downstairs and find out what the heck's going on. So thank you very much, and thank you for consideration of this bill.
Thank you very much.
And Madam Chair, just so the community knows, I think it's outrageous that somebody has to pay $35 to file a complaint when their dog has been attacked. I mean, we'll find out what's going on.
That's why we have this bill in front of us. So. Okay. Do we have any questions from the committee? Thank you very much. Okay. We will close.
Madam Chair.
Senator Byer.
Before you close the committee, I'd like to ask counsel a question or two about some definitions.
Please do.
On page 1, line 15, subsection 2, person commits a crime of hindering and with criminal negligence. I guess I'd like to know what the level of proof of criminal negligence is and what the crime specifically is on this bill.
Criminal negligence, thank you, Chair Burdick and Senator Beyer. Criminal negligence is defined in Oregon statutes. It's one of the four mental states for criminal law, intentional, knowing, reckless, and then criminal negligence. The actual definition, first of all.
So it's the lowest of the four?
It is.
Lowest.
It's the lowest of the four.
I've got it right here if you want to look at it.
Thank you.
What statute is it?
That's the definition. It's 161085.
The definition, you can look at it there. I can also, a person fails to be aware of a substantial and unjustifiable risk that something will happen. This risk must be so significant that failure to be aware of it is a, quote, gross deviation from the standard of care that a reasonable person would observe. My understanding of in criminal law, that there aren't a lot of crimes that criminal negligence attaches to, but some, just for example, there is a crime of like criminally negligent homicide, 163-145, which would generally be non-alcohol related car accidents where somebody ends up dying. There are also like child neglect, 163.545. I think the classic situation there would be leaving an infant in a car on a really hot day or something with the windows up, and something bad results from that. 163-200, criminal mistreatment, is another statute. I think it relates largely to care of elderly, that criminally negligent can be the mental state that's applied. There are a few other ones. Buying wildlife parts, removing stuff from riverbeds, that criminal negligence can attach to criminal liability. Does that answer your question?
Yes, it does. And the one more, I guess, on the next subsection A, when it speaks of attempts to injure or attempts to disable, are those words well defined? Is that term well defined, or is that kind of open ended? Or
I'd say it's without reserving judgment on how well it's defined. Disabled and injures is specifically defined,
mm-hmm.
and that's clarification that many statutes don't give. Like, for example, existing law says a tax, and it's been up to court cases to develop what a tax means, is my guess, what we refer to as the common law. This actually provides a definition, and then attempts is just sort of a substantial step towards either disabling or injuring. That's how criminal law defines attempt. Did you take a substantial step towards either one of these two?
So as an example, if a dog barks at another dog, could that be considered an attempt to injure?
I would say possibly an attempt to disable.
Verbal intimidation, you mean?
Right.
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, what about, just go one further from that, and interferes with. That's How is that defined? I mean, I would almost think barking would be interfering with more than... I mean, how is there any definition there, or are we creating new art here?
Senator Cruz, I don't believe there is a definition of interferes with.
Okay.
All right. Senator Pazansky?
I would say that when you look at the mental state that's required, that they're trying to put a threshold, one that's low as to making certain that these type of conducts are covered, but at the same time, it's above and beyond just in the case that Senator Barr said, if one dog barked at another, that in itself, I think in the eyes of the court, would not be sufficient unless the owner of the other dog did not take steps to, let's say, reduce the situation of where it could become more intimidating, threatening, growling, approaching or attacking. So it may be that we need to try to tighten this up a little bit, but I think the intent is to not be all-inclusive, and that's why I think legislative council has actually tried to give some type of parameters on definitions of disable and injures as compared to attack, which was really up for, let's say, broad discussions as to what would or wouldn't be considered attack. Mm-hmm. And give us clarity there. The other thing, Madam Chair, I guess I wanted to point out, based on one of the witnesses talk about the frustrations they have as to, as he said, street people blocking the sidewalk and needing something to be done, where there's already a statute that covers that, which is disorderly conduct in the second degree, and the point that's relevant is if a person obstructs vehicle or pedestrian traffic on a public way. So clearly there's stuff there. It's just more of an enforcement issue. Mm-hmm. As to it being actually addressed.
Thank you for getting that on the record, Senator Pazansky, because that really, that particular scenario is not specific to what the kind of conduct that this bill is applying to. It's not a case where the people are attacking trying to injure the dog or disable the dog. They're just standing there and getting in the way. So thank you for pointing out that that's existing law. I think we know what we're trying to do here. We're trying to kind of parse out the kind of conduct that is going to actually keep a dog from being functional, a dog that's been highly trained. And I'm sure these dogs are used to the hurly-burly, like coming to a hearing in Salem. They all seem to be keeping their cool very well among all these politicians. But we're trying to get at the kind of conduct that will actually result in getting these dogs out of service and or forcing them out of service. So I think we've got a few more considerations to give to this bill, including the question that we have about the non-economic damages. But I think I'm certainly persuaded by the testimony that there's a problem out there with these highly trained, dedicated dogs and their highly trained, dedicated handlers. So we will continue working on this. And I want to thank everybody who came here and brought their dogs. Senator Walker.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was in my office actually watching the hearing because my grandpuppy came to visit. He's on his way back to Montana, and he got injured this morning, so I had Senator Schrader looking at him, and I was listening to the testimony, and it was extremely powerful, and I appreciate that you all came today. I was thinking about bringing my grandpuppy up, but he's not a service dog. He's a Labradoodle, but he's very calm, much calmer than my puppy.
A calm Labrador?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, well, he's a Labradoodle. So anyway, thank you, and I appreciated the testimony that you all gave today. And I know this committee is real interested in working on this bill.
Thank you again for coming. Okay, we will close the hearing on Senate Bill 438. And we'll stick with the theme that we've got going here, and we'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 406. Committee will stand at ease for a moment.
We've got the rookie team coming in. The B team.
Not
junior varsity.
waiting for a
not quite.
Well, I was going to put on the record that he was spoiled. Is he okay?
Yeah, Kurt said we should keep him on the leash 4 to 5 days. Yeah, yeah. That energy. But he did go out on the beach yesterday.
So cute. Very adorable.
He's adorable. His hand is so big.
Yeah.
Our mics are on.
Oh my gosh, how many dogs did we have in here?
He'll be at ease for about 2 minutes. You can just turn the record off. This record's good. Council.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 406 concerns humane investigation agencies and humane special agents. It defines a humane investigation agency as a private, nonprofit animal care agency that has maintained an animal welfare department for at least 5 years. It has employees commissioned as special agents by the governor. It allows a humane investigation agency to request the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training Commission, to commission persons as humane special agents if designated by the humane investigation agency and certified by the department. It gives commissioned humane special agents the powers of peace officers to enforce animal welfare laws, although they serve at the expense, quote unquote, of the HIA. HIA stands for Humane Investigation Agency. Makes the HIA civilly responsible for any abuse of the agent's authority. It requires the department to recommend and to establish rules and standards, a training program, and procedures for evaluating humane special agents. It requires the department, subject to terms and conditions that it may impose, to certify humane special agents who successfully complete training, and allows the department to deny, suspend, or revoke the certification of a humane special agent. It requires the humane investigation agency to pay the department the cost of the training. It allows an humane investigation agency to employ a person as a humane special agent for up to 18 months or an additional year if provided an extension by the department before being certified by the department. It requires a person employed as a humane special agent to begin certification training no later than 90 days after employment by a HIA, but allows an HIA to delay the commencement of training for an extra 30 days if it can provide an explanation to the department.
Thank you. We'll start off with Sharon Harmon. Welcome to the committee. You're the only one. Oh, and Mark Wells, I'm sorry. I almost overlooked you, Mr. Wells. Sorry about that.
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, I am Sharon Harmon, and I'm the executive director of the Oregon Humane Society. A little point of clarification, we're not connected to any other humane organization, no matter how big the title. There is no national group, no national umbrella organizations. We're not related to the Humane Society of the United States, the ASPCA, or any other group with a very similar name. Bad marketing on our part, I apologize. We have been working for animals on behalf of this community since 1868. Through the years, we've had many jobs. We've protected draft animals. We've protected children. And now we've narrowed our focus to companion animals and other animals in need. We are entirely privately supported. The last time we had a contract for government services was in 1972 when we parted ways. And our board of directors and myself have every intention of keeping that way. So, remarkably, we're not here to ask for money, and I doubt you'll ever see the Oregon Humane Society here to do so. What we are here today to ask you for is to put into code the practice that has been the practice of the state to protect animals through the use of privately employed humane agents since the turn of the century, that is the turn of the century from 1800 to 1900. We
We've been working on this law at the request of the governor's office. It has been the practice of the governors of this state to commission agents that are privately employed and empower them as peace officers. And up until about 6 years ago, that came with no restrictions on authority. And as a citizen of the state, I don't think that's the best interest of government. We'd like to see our authority and the authority of other humane agents restricted to enforcing the animal cruelty laws of the state of Oregon. We'd like to have that same power of arrest and authority as a peace officer that we've enjoyed for over 100 years. And we'd like to have that put into statute. And that's what Senate Bill 406 is. Senate Bill 406 provides humane agents at no cost to the state of Oregon or any other jurisdiction. We have no aspirations of grandeur. It already costs the Oregon Humane Society about $80,000 a year per investigator. And we have three full-time investigators that are supported entirely by donations. We're not here to ask for money. We don't charge a fee for our services. Well, maybe adoptions, but even that's negotiable. We'd just like to continue to do our job as we have on behalf of the most vulnerable population in the state, and that's abused animals. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions from the committee?
Yes, I have one.
Senator Walker.
Thank you. Ms. Herman, I wouldn't care if you did come and ask for money. Because I care a lot about animals, as you can tell when I call them my grandpuppies. But my question is, if you're going to have the Department of Public Safety and Standards and Training do the training, who's paying for the training?
Senator Walker, Chair Burdick, we currently pay for that training. Our officers go through the DPSST training. It's a 12 to 16-week course that is entirely paid for by the donors to the Oregon Humane Society.
Okay. So.
And that training is ongoing now at the DPSST?
Chair Burdick, our most junior investigator just graduated about a month ago, had his graduation ceremony.
Chair, well, we were just out at the training facility.
We were driving cars around.
And shooting guns.
Shooting guns.
I don't know if your officers are trained to do that. Probably so. Would you add, with this law, you're just going to ingrain it in statute and you're not going to add any officers? We'll just still have three full-time ones?
We may, as the need arises.
Okay.
We have always filled in the gap between what your tax dollars pay for and your heart desires. But again, it's at substantial expense. Without any going through the academy, without any Hurricane Katrina or fires in California disaster, it's about $240,000 a year. It's cost is a barrier to us to adding services. Mm-hmm. We believe that our role in the protection of animals is to educate, and that may mean educating other law enforcement agents. It doesn't do us any good to take a call for a horse abuse case in LeGrand and hot foot on over there and go look at the horse. It serves the community better when we can work with the local sheriff and say, here are the elements of a crime. What do you got? How can we help you? And that way, agencies are empowered, and frankly, we don't have the horse.
I guess I'm still a little unclear as to why you need a statute if you're already doing it.
Chair Burdick, our empowerment comes from a commission from the governor's office, and it's a very vague statute. And the governor has signed our commission cards that give us full peace officer status without any limitations. And with Governor Kulongoski's office, we have a contract that limits our scope, but it's outside of statute. One of the challenges we face is when we go to court and some clever defense attorney thinks he's got the loophole, and he says, well, these people don't have any powers to effect a search warrant or to arrest my client, and we have to go through the explanation and the justification for our empowerment, which has stood the test of courts.
But for the record, this wouldn't change anything about how you actually operate in connection with these officers.
Chair Burdick, you're correct. It would not change, but it would establish for any other humane investigation agency a protocol for training. I mean, as guardians of this state, you know, it's up to you to put in the safeguards so that people have adequate protections and resources, and this is a giant step forward into that.
So this would affect the Humane Society and anyone else, local animal control agencies as well?
Chair Burdick, this because of the way it was written, as it comes in our workings with the governor's office, it really reflects two agencies, the Humane Society of Redmond and the Oregon Humane Society. There are no other private humane societies that have humane agents at this time, nor could there be if this bill passes.
So if another location wanted to set up a humane agency like yours, they'd have to come in and get separate statutory authority?
Or they, Chair Burdick, they could work through our organization or the Humane Society of Redmond to provide training, to provide internship, to provide under the auspices. Of course, that would mean taking on all the responsibility and liability for those individuals until they fit within the definition of the statute.
Okay, so what is it about the definition that only applies to Portland and Redmond?
It is Section 1, lines 4 through 6, Chair Burdick, members of the committee.
So the one that really limits you is the reference that you've had officers commissioned.
Mm-hmm. Chair Burdick, members of the committee.
Agents under the statute that you say is too vague.
Right. And that criteria is in there because of concerns that who would qualify. And looking for experience, looking for history, looking for a track record. Because this is a leap of faith on your part. We recognize that.
Okay. Thank you. Other questions from the committee? Mr. Wells.
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, good afternoon. My name is Mark Wells, and I am currently the lead humane investigator at the Oregon Humane Society. Thank you for this opportunity to speak on behalf of Senate Bill 406 and the positive impact our humane investigators have throughout Oregon. We have a department of 3 full-time investigators who currently are commissioned by our governor to investigate and enforce our state animal cruelty laws. Our staff are professionally trained and had years of sworn law enforcement experience at the municipal and county level prior to joining the Oregon Humane Society. While we specialize in humane law enforcement, our impact reaches far beyond the animals we protect. In the course of our normal investigations of animal neglect and abuse, we routinely discover family and individual neglect and abuse, illegal drug manufacturing and distribution, untreated mental illness, and a host of other more serious crimes than the original animal concern. Through our many contacts and established relationships with local and regional law enforcement and social services, our investigators are positively impacting and improving the lives of many families and communities throughout Oregon. As a former municipal police officer here in Oregon, I can attest firsthand that our police agencies simply do not have the personnel or resources to adequately enforce our strong animal cruelty laws. As you well know, we are in a statewide crisis simply providing enough patrol officers to respond to 911 calls for service. Law enforcement agencies throughout the state depend on our resources and specialized training to investigate almost 1,000 cases of criminal animal neglect, abuse, and abandonment each year. If our position is dissolved, these crimes and the many victims simply would not be addressed, much less prosecuted. The clear link between animal crimes and violence against humans is proven and undeniable. I see this link almost daily in the hundreds of homes and communities I visit throughout the state of Oregon. There is a continued need for professionally screened and trained humane special agents, and your support of this bill will allow the Oregon Humane Society and its dedicated staff of investigators to continue providing this valuable service to our citizens and our local and regional law enforcement agencies without the use of a single tax dollar. Thank you for the support of this bill.
Thank you very much. Are there questions from the committee? Okay. Our next witness will be Mary Botkin and Thomas Buckles. We're both against it, so you can come up together.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Mary Botkin, and I'm here today representing the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. We represent animal control officers working in Multnomah County, Clackamas, Lane, Columbia, and many of the rural areas as well. We have about 300 members statewide who work for animal control. animal control is a duty and a responsibility that operates through the Sheriff's Department. And currently, our members answer directly to the elected sheriff of that county. Our concern with this bill is not the three humane agents that currently exist, but rather the expansion of that responsibility to cover other areas. One of the concerns that we have, and we had it last session, we continue to have it this session, and that is that the Humane Society is a voluntary organization. It does not respond, or it is not responsible to any elected official, nor is it responsible to the taxpayers. And while the governor has appointed three on a temporary basis, it is interesting. We have no problem with the Humane Society. Let me just be very clear. But we do have a problem with people who are taking, who are responsible for enforcing laws, have the right to take possession, and have the right to arrest people who do not have a direct responsibility to the taxpayer or to the voters. And our members do have that responsibility. They carry all of the legal liability, and I believe that no matter what we do as a governmental body, we cannot move our liability from the government for a government service to a private entity. If there is an unfortunate incident, and there hasn't been, but if there is damage, the citizen who is damaged is always going to go back to the elected officials. They may very well sue the Humane Society, but they will also sue the county. And if the county doesn't have any control over who's being hired, how they're being trained, who's doing what, if they have no control over the duties those people are performing, it seems a little
loose. How could they have a suit against the county if the county wasn't involved?
Because I think that it's like anything else, Madam Chair. It is ultimately in statute a governmental responsibility to provide animal protection and oversight of animal cruelty laws.
Yeah, but if you had a something that went wrong and the county was nowhere there, it seems a stretch to think that the county could be sued.
I think that you would find that would be, any good lawyer would sue everybody that they could possibly sue.
Has the county ever been sued, to your knowledge, on the existing humane officers?
But you're talking about a significant expansion of their duties.
Expansion of their duties?
Yes.
Okay, but the testimony was that it would actually be a narrowing down of their duties.
I respectfully disagree. And our legal counsel respectfully disagrees.
Okay. Are there questions from the committee? Thank you. Mr. Buchholz.
Yes, thank you for the opportunity to speak today. In 1991, I lived on 84th and Duke Street. I had an animal control officer from Multnomah County. I had a Multnomah County deputy sheriff. I had two Portland police invade my yard, take my animal, and left me a ticket and a note saying that if I didn't come get my animal within 144 hours, they were going to kill my animal. They did not give me the search warrant that by law I was mandated. When I went to get my animal, they didn't like my attitude, so they weren't going to give my animal back to me. And I had to get down on the floor and beg for my animal's life. And ever since then, I have not been I believe that animal control is necessary, but I think there's absolutely no oversight over any of this matter. And Senate Bill 255 that was passed into law in 2003, I think, goes to prove it. In Senate Bill 255, what they did was they added the words to law enforcement agency. They had the normal ones. They had any city or municipal police department, any county sheriff, or any state police. And then they added a law division of the Humane Society in Oregon that employs special agents authorized under ORS 131805, and a law enforcement division of a county or municipal animal control agency that employs sworn agents. And this was to investigate the Oregon State Criminal Code. So I complained to the governor and asked him to veto it, which he didn't do. He passed 255 into law. On November 8, 2004, the Oregonian article about Randy Covey stated, for all the in-depth work Covey's performed in his 7 years with the Humane Society, it wasn't until this summer when the state changed certification requirements to receive formal police training. Well, I wrote my Wayne Scott, my representative, a letter, and he had the legislative council answer it, and they said that there were no changes. So I got to looking around here. Well, ORS 131805 was passed in the year 1905, authorizing the governor to employ special agents and to fix their salaries approximately, money therefore, providing the manner of payment. Well, I feel that this law is being tweaked a little bit because I don't think that the governor employs these gentlemen. And in subsequent years, in 1905, he was given $10,000 to employ him. Let's see here.
Mr. Buchholz, are you testifying on this bill, or are you still commenting on...
Well, no, I'm on the law now. 131805 is which the government gives them their ability to be special agents. But by no way are they employed by the state. In 1907, they were given $5,000 to employ special agents. 1913, they were given another $10,000. Then we have an attorney general's opinion in 1922 that states that the question is asked if the prohibition people can hire special agents. And it says here, it says state special agents are authorized to be appointed by the governor under Section 2695, that the governor is hereby authorized to employ special agents. Okay, it gets down here to the end. It says that these special agents are paid by vouchers from the Secretary of State. And I just don't think that these guys are being paid by the Secretary of State.
Okay, and do you have any comments that are specific to this bill?
Yes, I think that it needs to stay under the governor's control because under special agents, the governor is allowed to employ special agents, and he also has the ability to appoint railroad police. And I think this is going to take it out of there, and I think it needs to have some accountability by a state official, and I think that proper person is the governor.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. President.
And I also would like to state for the record that I think that instead of passing this bill, that there needs to be a task force to investigate how the state laws are being enforced within the state, because there's absolutely no oversight. Multnomah County is still writing tickets of infractions. Tickets of infractions went away in the year 2000. January 1st of 2000, this legislature did away with the word infraction. And I just think that there's no oversight, and there needs to be a task force assigned to look into this matter before any law is passed. Also, the Humane Society is very good at marketing, and they make a great deal of money off of complaining about all these animals that they take in. There is a law, it's under this, just a second. It's 133.379, the duty of police officers to arrest and prosecute violators for cruelty to animals and the distribution of fines. All distribution and forfeitures collected under violations of 167.315 to 340 shall be paid into the county treasury of the county in which it is collected and placed in.
Mr. Buchholz, I'm going to stop you right there because that that really doesn't pertain to this.
Yes,
bill.
It does, because these gentlemen will be taking people to court and under those statutes, and fines will be levied. And I just like Quantrell Woods, he gave them $10,000 because they arrested him. You know, it's. I think things like that need to be addressed, where all the money is going to go.
Okay, through your task force. Okay, well, thank you very much. Does anybody on the committee have any questions? Thank you very much.
Yep.
Okay, Marilyn Lawrence from the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training.
I don't know, today the girls just seem to be dogs.
I was waiting for somebody to see who's going to do it. Welcome to the committee.
For the record, my name is Marilyn Lawrence. I oversee the Standards and Certification Program for the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training. Chair Burdick and members of the committee, as introduced, Senate Bill 406 would make the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training the commissioning authority for humane special agents in Oregon. And it would also require the agency to develop a program of minimum standards and certification for humane special agents. Current Oregon law separates the role of the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training as a statewide certifying body from the authority granted to employers in a law enforcement environment to commission public safety individuals. The department is concerned about possible risk and about the perception or actual conflicts that could arise from our assuming dual roles with regard to humane special agents. Section 2 of Senate Bill 406 requires establishment of a separate set of minimum standards and required training specific to humane special agents. The area of animal care and welfare is outside of current DPSST jurisdiction and scope of expertise. The department has identified a fiscal impact for the bill as currently drafted and did submit that to the Legislative Fiscal Office late last week. However, the department and representatives from the Oregon Humane Society have also met late last week, discussed the concerns of our agency, and have had very collaborative and productive conversations. We believe that during the course of those discussions, we have identified possible amendment language that would alleviate the concerns of the department and remove the fiscal impact that we believe is in the bill as introduced. I'd be happy to answer any questions that you may have.
Other questions from the committee? Thank you. You mentioned the amendments, and I'd be interested in finding out more about them, and I've asked Senator Walker to maybe work with the two of you to see if something can be developed to address the fiscal aspects of it and also some of the concerns that were raised during the hearing.
Chair Burdick, we would be more than happy to do this. Our initial conversations were very collaborative and very positive.
Thank you very much. We will close any other comments from the committee? We will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 406. And I think we're going to do that work session.
Okay.
We'll open a work session on a bill that is named Senate Bill 271. Council.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 271 was originally heard by this committee on January 23rd. And concerns the process for waiving or deferring filing fees, court costs, and transcripts on appeal. There have been amendments submitted to the committee which delete sections 4 and 5 of Senate Bill 271. Senate 4 concerns the effect of a denial of an application for a fee waiver, and 5 refers to the nature of the money judgment if an obliger prevails in the case. The dash 2 amendments provide that if a quote-unquote person who receives a fee waiver prevails in the case, the court may require the losing party to pay the state or municipality or county, when applicable, the waived amounts. The dash 2 amendments also clarify that the waiver provisions in SB 271 apply only to fees and costs that are paid to the court. And I do believe that the committee has a hand-engrossed version of the bill, which will make it easier to read.
That's correct, but I don't see a dash 1 amendment. Are the dash 1 amendments included in the dash 2? Maybe is Kingsley here? You want to come on up and help guide us on this? Ms. Click? Welcome to the committee.
For the record, Kingsley Click, State Court Administrator, yes, the dash ones are part of dash two. The only thing that dash two did differently was to address an issue that the Collectors Association brought up on Friday, that by the Chapter 21 being rewritten as a new section, even though it included the same language, that they weren't sure it was going to stay in Chapter 21, and they had some concern that it would no longer be interpreted as just the fee and waiver provisions for court fees. And so we put in payable to the court to clarify, no matter where that section ends up, that it did not address their changing other things that could be waived.
Thank you. And those changes were non-substantive in nature?
Yes.
They didn't change existing.
They didn't change the law.
Okay. So basically, if we adopt the Dash 2 amendments, we will have the content of the Dash 1 amendments plus the concerns that the collectors had.
Chair Burdick, City Council, correct.
Okay.
Dash 2 just added payable to the court to clarify the fees we were talking about.
All right. Well, this is kind of a complicated little measure, but it looks like it's pretty well in shape. So, Senator Beyer, do you have a motion?
I don't know if I do or not. I'm still looking.
Would you like to hold off on it? The Dash 2s are fairly recent, as you can see from the date. If you're more comfortable delaying it, we do have an opportunity to come back tomorrow on this.
Madam Chair, I guess if there was anybody that still had a problem with the bill was concerned about, they'd probably be here, so I guess I'll move the Dash 2 amendments to Senate Bill 271.
Senator Beyer has moved the Dash 2 amendments to Senate Bill 271. Is there any discussion? Any objections? So ordered. Senator Beyer.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 271 as amended to the floor with a two-pass recommendation.
Senator Beyer has moved Senate Bill 271 as amended to the Senate floor with a two-pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Do I have a volunteer to carry this?
I'll do it.
You'll do it?
Sure, why not?
The workhorse, Senator Pinsansky, will carry this.
If Senator Barrick makes the motion, I can carry the bill.
I was in a contest last session and won, so I'm not in any big hurry to be the person who carried the most bills of the session.
Well, why do you wear your pedometer? I'll get off your back. Okay. We will now open a public hearing on our last bill of the day, Senate Bill 300. Council.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 300 provides that a debtor's right to receive a federal child tax credit and all money that is traceable to the payment of the child tax credit is exempt from execution by a judgment creditor.
Okay. We will start out with Brett Knutson from the Oregon State Bar. And whoever you want to bring with you.
That sounds reasonable.
No, David Neville. Just kidding. Okay, there's three of you, and I have three signed up, so let's see if you're the same one. Go ahead. Welcome to the committee.
Hi, I'm Brett Knutson. I'm appearing on behalf of the Consumer Law Section for the Oregon State Bar, testifying in favor of Senate Bill 300. However, I'd like to defer my turn to Star Riccardi. She may begin.
Could you speak up, please?
May I defer my turn to Star Riccardi?
Absolutely. Just identify yourself for the record, please.
Hi, my name is Star Riccardi. I am here in support of the Senate Bill 300. I live in Beaverton, Oregon. I am a mother of two, working mother, single, divorced, slash, whatever you want to call it. And my kids are 9 and 11 years old. And my eldest son has autism. I have worked full-time for a bank now for almost 6 years. This year it'll be 6 years. My gross income last year was right around $23,000. So just to kind of give you a little bit of background of who I am and, you know, where I kind of stand. I do make a fairly decent living, considering the fact that I have a bit of debt from the past. I am in a position to where I am having to file bankruptcy. My debt was incurred mostly from my father living with me. He became fairly ill after a stroke and wasn't able to work. He wasn't quite old enough for Medicare yet. We had to pay for privately paid insurance as a result of some things, which, you know, for a single mother of two, it becomes a little difficult to come up with $485 a month to pay for private insurance. So I took out a loan on my car that was previously paid for, did what I could to take care of my father. Well, those issues have pretty much been resolved, but past debt always does catch up with you one way or another. Just because of the fact, I'm sure you've heard many stories about the dilemmas of single mothers, and it sometimes gets a little difficult just to meet the month-to-month expenses of rent, utilities, car insurance, food. My kids eat more than I do already, and they're only 9 and 11, so I can imagine, you know, when they're 14 and 16, I'm going to be in quite the predicament there. Hopefully I'll make more money by then. But anyway, as a result of all of this, I make enough money to where I don't qualify for assistance. I don't qualify for food stamps. I don't qualify for child care assistance. So I have to pay for all of this out of my pocket. Not even for free or reduced lunches at their school. So as you can imagine, things get a little tight once in a while. But there's always that one time of year when, for me, tax time is actually great. I love doing my taxes. Because I actually get a bit of a refund back, and it gives me a little bit of breathing space. This year, I had the issue of an unexpected expense of the engine on my car blew, and you know, it's going to cost $1,200 to get that fixed. Well, when I'm living paycheck to paycheck, $1,200 just doesn't drop out of the sky. I mean, you know, so basically my car is still sitting broken down. I'm driving my dad's old work truck to take my kids to school and back and to go to work, which, of course, I'm thankful for. It's better than walking, believe me. But, you know, in this particular instance, I'm looking forward to my tax return, being able to either fix the car that I have. It's been sitting for quite a while. If it's going to be drivable, I don't know. Or just buying, you know, a used car to be able to get to work and back, take my kids back and forth. It'd be nice if I could have enough left over to maybe buy some much-needed clothes and socks for the boys. Their socks are full of holes. And not to sound pathetic, because, you know, I can for the most part, but on top of all this, I'm having my wages garnished, which, as I'm sure you are, they can take 25% of my income. And so considering that what I actually make a month, my monthly expenses, then they're garnishing my wages as well. I have another garnishment after that. I have a couple of judgments against me. And so when I get my taxes back, I'm a little worried that, you know, they're just going to jump into my checking account and take it. And when I'm hoping to at least get a car and maybe put some money in my children's lunch account to pay for a couple months worth of lunches, because that cost me about, it's $100 a month. It's $5 a day, and I have two children. So
maybe you could talk about the bill.
The bill itself would not enable them. They wouldn't be able to take money that I get from the additional checks and the additional tax, child tax credit, from me, for my past debt. It would enable me to keep some of that money so I could use it, as I'm sure it was intended, for my children. Okay. And that's basically what I'm here for. Okay.
Thank you. Are there questions from the committee?
Have one. Thank you, Ms. Riccardi. Do you qualify for the earned income tax credit?
I do qualify.
All right. Thank you.
Okay. Other questions?
My name is Rex Daines. I'm an attorney. I'm a partner in the law firm of Olson, Olson & Daines. Our firm is here locally, but we have offices throughout the state, and we're the second largest consumer bankruptcy firm in the state, and we see a lot of people in the same position as the lady that you just spoke, that you just heard from. A lot of people don't understand what the additional earned income, additional child tax credit is. So I made a little chart to show you what it's not. And by showing you what it's not, it's easy to figure out what it is. But if you look at this graph, the large graph is the earned income credit. And the earned income credit's been around a long time. Prior to becoming an attorney, I volunteered on the Volunteer Income Tax Assistance where we help a lot of lower-income people file their tax returns, and this was why they came to see us, because they knew this money was out there for them to receive a refund. It was originally designed to give a person back the amount of withholding taxes that their employer withheld from their wages and the matching funds that the employer paid. Over time, it's increased to an amount in excess of that because of the way the IRS tax code works. It's increased based on inflation, not based on what the employers withhold. Later, they instituted the child tax credit, which is the lighter gray line, and that's the per-child tax credit that can be up to $1,000 per child. And that's available to anyone whose income is less than $160,000. It's pretty much standard up through $150,000, and then it tapers off. Currently, the Oregon laws allow the earned income credit portion to be exempt from execution, which means creditors cannot get into somebody's bank account, take money that came from the earned income credit. Currently, the child tax credit can be levied. There's a hole you can see on the graph where people are getting less earned income credit, but they're not getting the full amount of the child tax credit based on their other tax criteria. This is what the additional child tax credit was intended to resolve. Based on the formula, it's not a beautiful line that fills in this hole there, but that was the design of it. So there's a lot of people that this bill is intended to protect whose income is in this area. The lady to my right is squarely in that area where she's getting a tax refund that is not child tax credit and not earned income credit, but it's the additional child tax credit designed to protect these people in the income range, generally between about $20,000 and $50,000. The numbers I used on this chart are for a married couple with two children, and these are the amounts that, just based on the standard deductions, how much they would receive in the tax credits. It is very difficult for debtors who are facing a bankruptcy or a garnishment from several sources to receive a tax refund, have a creditor garnish it from their bank account, or have the bankruptcy trustee take that money to pay these old debts when they're really struggling to stay current on their current bills. I think Senate Bill 300 would extend what, I'm not sure the name of the prior Senate bill was, that made the earned income credit exempt from execution, but I think it's a good policy and it should be extended to the additional child tax credit.
Now, Mr. Daines, right?
Yes.
How old is this? When did this earned income, when did this child tax credit go in? This is, I assume you're talking about the federal tax child tax credit. When did that go into effect?
6 years ago, maybe five. It was part of the tax credits that President Bush instituted. Mm-hmm. I believe it was the first year of his presidency when they did that. I'm not sure, but that's when the child tax credit.
And the way this works is the same as the earned income tax. If you qualify for it, even if your tax liability is zero, you still get it. Is that correct?
The additional child tax credit, you will still get some. The child tax credit, you will not get any if your tax liability is zero.
Say that again.
You will never receive a child tax credit if your tax liability is zero.
Okay, and unlike the earned income tax credit.
Right, earned income credit, you will get additional child tax credit. What we're talking about today, you will get, even if you say, I have $30,000 of income, these are my standard and itemized deductions. If the number after that is zero, you can still get the additional child tax credit, which is the subject of this bill.
Okay, that's different than what I heard you saying. So basically, the way this credit works is exactly the same way as the earned income tax credit works.
That's correct. It's a different formula, of course,
right,
but it's designed to fill in the gap between the earned income and the child tax credit.
And you can get either credit even if your total tax liability after deductions is zero.
That's correct.
Okay. That's for the record. Thank you. Any questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Is there anything you wanted to add?
I did want to add one thing, and I'm glad you brought that up. The bankruptcy laws changed approximately 18 months ago, and the new bankruptcy law looks at a person's income and compares it to the state average. If you're above the state average, it's unlikely that you'll qualify for a regular bankruptcy, a Chapter 7, which eliminates the debt. There's some, of course, unique circumstances where you still qualify, but for the most part, you don't qualify. You're required to do a Chapter 13 and pay back a portion of the debt, which includes paying in tax refunds to the bankruptcy court. The average income in the state of Oregon for a family of four is $63,946. And a person in that category would not qualify for an additional child tax credit. So the group of people we're talking about that this bill would protect and allow them to keep the larger portion of their tax refund are people that will qualify for a bankruptcy, and they're in that income group that the federal government thinks, hey, these people are entitled to a bankruptcy and they're entitled to put the old debts behind them and move forward.
Okay. Thank you very much. Questions from the committee?
Just one.
Senator Walker.
Thank you. Mr. Daines, I know you know the answer to this because you're a practitioner in bankruptcy court, and I see you there frequently. So either you or Mr. Knudsen are both aware that in 2001, I obtained an exemption for the earned income credit. And just last session, I increased the amounts for homestead and auto exemption. Wouldn't that be correct?
That is correct.
Talk to me a little bit, if you would. I'm not sure you were on the negotiation team. I don't think you were on the homestead and the auto, were you?
I was not.
I didn't think so. I didn't remember that. So I'll ask some other party who comes up to testify about that, because we had a conversation about it. And each time that we take these exemptions in the bankruptcy code, which, you know, I thought these were reasonable exemptions, what are we doing? Are we exempting those assets then from creditors?
That's correct.
Is that what you're doing?
That is money right now. Sorry, I've forgotten your name.
Star.
Star would be getting an additional child tax credit. I imagine, from what she told me about her income, it'd be about $700. And that would be in addition to the earned income credit she's entitled to. And right now, creditors would be entitled, or the bankruptcy court would take that money and divvy it up among the old creditors. And what this bill says is she gets to keep that extra money for her ongoing living, future living expenses.
Madam Chair.
Senator Walker.
Thank you. But Ms. Riccardi also gets to exempt her earned income credit. She also has an increase in her homestead and her auto because of the work that we've done in the past, correct?
That is correct.
I just want to be clear, because I've been a court reporter in bankruptcy court for 23 years, and I've seen debtors come through and they have a really tough time. But you also have to recognize there are creditors. So I just want to make sure we have a very balanced system. And I just wanted to get that on the record.
Thank you.
Mrs. Burlington, also with the Oregon State Bar Consumer Law Section, I can address some of those concerns maybe. The creditor is still garnishing Ms. Riccardi. So the creditor will get their money. These are people, the people who get this credit, this refund, are people who have incomes. You have to earn a certain amount of money before you are entitled to get the refund, in this case $11,000. So we're not shutting the door on creditors. Certainly what we're doing is when you're being garnished and you're losing 25% of your income, and then you have this refund come in, which, in some cases, so you have two children and you overpay your taxes, you're going to get about $1,000 per child. So that chunk of money, that $2,000, goes a long ways toward helping people get out of trouble and catch up again on their other expenses. Mm-hmm. Let's say that she, as in her situation exactly, she has a car that she can't afford to repair because she is living basically paycheck to paycheck. She can't save any money. She's getting garnished 25%. She has several children that she's trying to provide the care for. Creditor is able, once they, if they, if she gets this.
I'm gonna stop you right here because we're almost out of time, and I've got one more person signed up who wants to speak against this, so to have a balanced presentation, I want to make sure we hear from them.
Madam Chair, can I just ask one quick question?
Yes, please, Senator Sasky.
At the end, you were saying what the family of four average in Oregon. I thought I heard you say $63,000.
Correct. That's the average income for a family of four in Oregon.
Wow.
That's pretty amazing.
It sounds like a lot of money.
Well, it does. I mean, compared to what we've seen in other scenarios.
Yeah.
I'd be interested in finding more out about that, how that number was reached. Thank you very much. Matt Marquis.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Matt Marquis representing the Oregon Collectors Association today, and we are opposed to Senate Bill 300. I'm not an expert in bankruptcy and garnishment, and I hope to have somebody here today, but they canceled on me at the last minute, so here I am. We did participate in the work group that Senator Walker talked about last session that dealt with not only the homestead and auto exemption, but we also looked at this bill as well because it was introduced last session. I don't recall the bill number, but all three of those issues came to that work group. We discussed them, and while not all parties at the table were as happy as they could have been maybe with the outcomes of that work group, including ourselves, we agreed to deal with the homestead and auto exemptions and leave the additional child tax credit alone at that time. And I didn't know how long we were going to leave it alone, but apparently until this session, here it is again. I just want to point out a couple of things. They said that this is for distressed families, and at the same time, their testimony said that, I believe they said anyway, that somebody qualifies for this tax credit if they make up to $150,000. And while those folks may not be filing bankruptcy, this does also affect the garnishments issued to individuals at financial institutions. So I don't know that it's only dealing with distressed families. And it is just one more hit against creditors as to what they can and cannot, or what they are eligible to. With that, Madam Chair, I'm just going to—I'll leave it to answer any questions you may have.
But your point is that this would even families who can't do the bankruptcy under the new federal rules, that it would affect other kinds of garnishments.
Yes, Madam Chair. I believe that if somebody deposited their tax refund check and a portion of that was an additional child tax credit, that portion would be exempt from garnishment if this bill were to pass.
If this could be limited down to only the people who qualify for that type of bankruptcy, would that alleviate your concerns or some of them?
Madam Chair, in the... That's not something that I had thought about, but it would alleviate some of those concerns with garnishment. You'd still have those issues with bankruptcy, and people file bankruptcy for a variety of reasons. And if you have somebody making the kind of money that they were talking about filing bankruptcy, which, granted, probably doesn't happen a lot, I think there's a legitimate question about whether or not they should be able to keep up to $1,000 a child away from creditors that they owe money to.
Well, but as I understand, and I'm not the bankruptcy expert that Senator Walker here is.
Nor am I.
As I understand it, and correct me at any point, Senator Walker, but under the new bankruptcy laws, only lower income people can file for the, is it Chapter 7? It's been very limited to what kind of people can use that type of bankruptcy, and it's income related. Am I?
Yes, Madam Chair, you're right. There's an income test, and if you don't meet the income test, you cannot file a 7. You have to file a 13, which puts you on a payment plan to repay your debts over 3 or 5 years.
Okay, so I guess my question is if it could be limited down to a lower income level, along the lines of our witness before, Ms. Riccardi, would that alleviate some of the concerns?
Madam Chair, I'd like to see how that were to happen, but, yeah, that would alleviate some of the concerns. Exemptions are always an issue, and we took some pretty big increases last session in some pretty significant exemptions, the homestead and auto, and those were both raised by 20-plus percent. And frankly, I think those were pretty substantial increases, and I'd advocate for no more increases, obviously, but I understand your point, Madam Chair, and we would be willing to work with that at least.
Okay. Madam Chair.
Senator Walker.
Well, Mr. Marquis thinks those were substantial increases. But you know that we all walked away from the table a little bit. Some of us felt like we didn't get enough, and some of us felt like you got too much. So, but it was a carefully negotiated agreement, but Oregon still is in the middle of the western states, and you know, and I think we're outrageous in our exemptions, but I do have to say with Mr. Marquis, agree with him, that we had this discussion about this child care credit, and we decided not to go forward with it. Part of it is because it is given to people with high income, mm-hmm. and you know, they're not all people who have a blown car engine, though I have to say mine blew out when I was in Montana, and I had to take out not a second mortgage, but a home equity line of credit to buy a car. So we all have those problems, but Madam Chair, I'd be interested in exploring this a little bit further if you want to. But right now, I don't think I could support the bill.
And Madam Chair, just so you're aware as well, there is a miscellaneous exemption of up to $400 that individuals can take. Whether or not that, probably, obviously, the proponents of the measure aren't suffice with that. But there is that, at least, on the books now.
Well, we have a bankruptcy expert on the committee, so at risk of overburdening you, Senator Walker, would you be willing to work with the parties and see if we can narrow this down to something that would be more appropriate? Senator Barr.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just to make sure that I'm familiar with this or reading it right, the homestead exemption, the auto exemption, the $400 miscellaneous exemption, those are all one-time exemptions when the bankruptcy is filed and done at first. Originally were this and the earned income tax credit would be an ongoing credit. Is that correct? One time versus every year?
Madam Chair, Senator Beyer, you know, I think it would still be a one-time exemption. I'm not 100% sure. That's something I hadn't thought of. And frankly, we deal more with garnishments than we do with bankruptcy. So in that circumstance, I guess if you were being garnished more than one time, it would be an ongoing.
Well, Madam Chair, I could answer Senator Byer's question. When you file your bankruptcy papers, you take the election for whatever exemption you qualify for, and you're right, the homestead and the auto are one-time exemptions when you file a bankruptcy. And you take an exemption for the earned income credit, that comes to you each year.
That's what I said. It's an ongoing
thing.
So
if you're in a Chapter 13 bankruptcy and you've got a three-year plan, each year you get that credit, no one can take it from you. It's not a part of your repayment plan.
Okay.
And that therefore would make that true with the child care credit.
Yes.
If I'm correct, and I think Mr. Daines would nod or shake his head, I'm correct. Am I not, Mr. Daines?
Yes, you are correct.
I am. Okay.
Madam Chair,
Senator Cruz.
I'm just not sure, because if you're filing under Chapter 13, you're set on a payment schedule. I'm not sure how. I mean, all these things are considered into that in setting up the payment schedule, aren't they?
If it's an exemption under the statute, then you get that exemption every single year that you're in the bankruptcy.
Right, but the payment schedule is done with those allowances in mind.
Correct.
Yes.
Correct.
Okay. Well, let's see if we can work and narrow this down.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. We're going to close the public hearing. And before we adjourn, committee, tomorrow's meeting, we worked so diligently today that we have nothing on our agenda tomorrow.
Yeah.
And so tomorrow's meeting is canceled. And on Wednesday, we have cell phone day. So everybody bring their cell phones.
Be in Eugene that day.
This committee is adjourned.
Oh, shoot.
Just going to get more fun and more fun, isn't it? Mm-hmm.